The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Well, we're in the middle of a section on the relation of faith to science, and I'm going to try to race through some of this, and then I have some kind of parting thoughts for you about the future of apologetics. This whole issue enfolds many, many other issues. We were in the midst of saying that science is a good and divine calling, some reminders about common grace tell us that there are true areas of conflict, but there are also areas of complementarity, and we called for doing more honest work both on the scientific front and in biblical hermeneutics. Let me introduce a bit of a parenthesis here. As you know, there's been a great deal of interest in the whole question of irreducible complexity. And I think I've been telling you that in the Veritas forum that I hang out with, there's almost always some request that a scientist who presents some kind of design argument be present as a lecturer, sometimes in the form of a debate, sometimes just to give lecture material, in favor of a biblical view, but not so much quoting from the Bible, but raising the possibility of creation because of the likelihood of design. And I think there's something to this. There is an intriguing history of the design argument that, in a way, just won't go away. It goes from the very intuitive, almost naive level of you look out there at the world and you see patterns. And when you look at the whole, design becomes an obvious option. Irreducible complexity is the argument used by a number of biologists. Perhaps one of the best known in recent times who does this is Michael Behe. And he's a Roman Catholic, a believer, but his argument doesn't depend directly on any kind of idea of revelation. He has a lecture and he has a book based on the idea of this black box. And as you know, Darwin's black box was a possible embarrassment to the whole theory of Darwinism. And the parallel that he makes is between the kind of impossibility of getting something like the human eye as just a step in evolution, because you just can't imagine how any of the parts would have evolved without the whole being in the view, and the famous mousetrap illustration. And if you've heard this, it's very beguiling. I mean, he shows how no single part of the mousetrap makes a lot of sense without putting it into a hole. It certainly won't catch a mouse. And so he says, you know, take the cheese, or take the spring, or take the little, you know, surface, or every little part of it, it just doesn't make sense. This harks back to Paley, William Paley's argument about the watchmaker. In the argument from design that William Paley set forth back in the 18th century, the idea was, look, if you come across a clock, none of the individual parts of this clock would seem to make a whole lot of sense as isolated from the whole. You know, what's a hour needle, or the small hand, or the escapement mechanism, or it must make sense only in terms of a whole. And I think some of Darwin's theories have been appropriately questioned with this kind of design alternative, irreducible complexity. And Darwin himself said that if you could, unless you could find a way to explain that the I evolved, my whole theory falls to the ground. However, I think we have to introduce a strong word of caution here. We should not, I think, assume that somehow by, let's say, careful scientific work, views such as autonomous evolution will just crumble and creationism will emerge triumphant. I think there's a danger in assuming that design arguments are sort of final arguments for a whole lot of reasons. It's strongly tied to natural law. And natural law is a double-edged sword. On the one hand, it seems to corroborate what the Bible says in a lot of places. And God reveals himself so clearly that, you know, how can you miss him? And the apostles plead for this. Acts chapter 14, you know, the argument at Lystra, or Acts 17, or Romans 1. Yet, on the other hand, it seems to claim that we can receive revelation and interpret it correctly without a changed heart. Those who believe in natural law tend to think there is something ingrained in the actual substance of the world, its laws, that, let me put it in the way one theologian put it in the 17th century, would reveal God even if God weren't there. In other words, the Creator's design is so much embedded in the law that it doesn't matter. I mean, this theologian didn't think that, of course, but it's so sure that it wouldn't matter if God were actually there or not. So, and another problem, of course, is the major problem that design is only one part of the revelation that's coming to us from the external world. What's another part? Well, evil. The whole disruption of design. The state of affairs that should not be. Not just, you know, storms and earthquakes and famines, but the very fabric of creation has been twisted in its direction. And as Paley's critics once suggested to him, so I think we have to suggest to some of the modern advocates of complexity, what do you do about evil in this scheme? How do you justify the presence of evil? Now, if we go all the way with natural law, then I think we've got to be willing to have some very hard questions asked to us. Furthermore, one of the arguments by natural law people or complexity people is that we have a model that explains everything in terms of a creator. And every time a new argument comes, such as the black box, then it's assumed to be one more kind of evidence marshaled for the defense of this. I remember a number of years ago, it was in the 60s really, when the Big Bang Theory seemed to become the consensus, and the steady state and other theories seemed to move into the background. You know, many Christians kind of jumped on this and said, you see, it's what we've been saying. It all started at zero, and what do you think happened before zero? Well, God was there. But the trouble is, the Big Bang actually doesn't speak about what happened before. And it would seem more compatible, obviously, with creation than a steady state where everything's there forever. But, you know, there are people who say, oh, well, there's a series of cycles of Big Bangs. And the Big Bang that created this world, or gave us this world, is only the tiny focus of the wave. Before that, there was an implosion, and it had its own Big Bang and so forth. So you'll find that it's always possible to make a theory marshaled for the service of your presupposition, no matter what that theory is. Indeed, Thomas Aquinas believed in a sort of steady state, and he was a creationist. Now, all this is saying, in a way, is what we've been saying all along in this course, and that is, proofs, evidences, yes. compelling arguments like design and so forth, of course. But don't put them as autonomous. Don't let them jump out of the context or the framework of a presupposition within which they will make sense. Otherwise, you're going to find yourself in a kind of a funny trap. Somebody will explain the complexity, and you'll be kind of at a loss. So this is a call to use those types of arguments with great caution, and not just triumphantly say, "See, we have a gotcha argument that you can't get around." It's interesting. I was at early last week. We were saying that look at history and learn from it. When Darwinism came around, it was intriguing how a number of Christians decided, "Well, that is the biblical model." And they sort of stretched the word yom in Genesis, and they noticed things in Genesis that said the earth brought forth, you know, and they said, well, there it is. It's evolution, you know. And then when classical Darwinism fell to the ground scientifically, not evolution, right, but Darwinism, it was pretty embarrassing for all the Christians who had invested their arguments saying, well, this is the true explanation of Genesis. So we just have to be really careful. I think a better way is what we were just creeping up on last week, which is to say, of course, scientific discovery and Genesis are utterly compatible. They totally are. It's the same God who gave us the world, the eyes to see it, and the Bible. However, until we have got a better grasp of what scientific discovery is giving us, and until we're ready with great humility to say, this seems to be acceptable theory, and until, on the other hand, we can say, I now understand what Genesis is all about, it's probably best not to come crashing in with a mature theory of how they work together. I personally have not seen one that's altogether satisfactory. Somebody last time mentioned this document at the PCA, which is a very interesting document that outlines four or five positions that one could take and still be within the Westminster Confession of Faith. And half in jest, I was saying it doesn't have my position in there. But I was pretty serious. My position is, let's wait and see. And I just don't know. And I'm not altogether happy with any of them that are in there. Probably something like the 24-hour day theory is the more hermeneutically kind of sound view of Genesis. But then you have to be very careful to move from that to say that Genesis is giving you a day in modern scientific chronological language, which it most certainly isn't. So what is it? I don't know. And it's okay not to know. As long as we affirm God is the creator, and we're able to say that he made Adam as a single person, and we're able to look at Genesis and say, this is how it happened. And then we go and do our work as scientists, and we try to figure out, what does the general revelation out there give us that either we see as compatible with Genesis, or is a problem with Genesis, which has got to be worked on, or just isn't involved with any of that. So in a certain way, I think it's a disappointing conclusion to come to, because we want to have, you know, the tie-ins. But in another way, I think that's how you have to work as an apologist, if you're honest to your presuppositions. Now, I want to do one more thing in the area of science, but before I do that, maybe two more things. Does anyone have any questions here about this, what I've said? It's a controversial area. Yeah. Go ahead. Very much so. I think you're on to something important. The Creation Week was a miracle week. However, there are a couple of caveats to that, which is the whole relationship of miracle to history, that it did happen in history. In my opinion, you don't want to lift the Genesis text out of the reality of history, even though it was an unusual, to say the least, kind of week, any more than you want to lift the miracle of the multiplication of the loaves and fishes out of history, because the fish were real, they were fed, and you might have to say, oh, look, science certainly can't explain how they kept coming out of the bags there, or whatever they were, the baskets, but it has to recognize that we're dealing with history here. So that would be my caution. When you begin to say miracle, you just have to be very careful that you're working with what the text is claiming as well. Moses, it seems to me, is not writing as though this were lifted from the rest of the history of the book of Genesis. Indeed, it seems to fit a pattern, you know, the famous Toledoth, these are the generations of, where Genesis is divided into these seven sections. And the heavens and the earth give the generations of human history. Furthermore, the language of the account, while admittedly semi-poetic, does not seem to be entirely poetic. That's why I have some problems with the sort of the framework hypothesis. I mean, I think it is acceptable in church courts, but I have a little trouble seeing a poet organizing days in terms of symmetry, and therefore kind of trumping the whole question of did this really happen in any kind of recordable history. So I take the point, but I'd want to be careful that you're not moving it out of anything measurable. I'm happier with that view than with the views that try much too hard, in my opinion, to make all these reconciliations. You know, I remember...
That's really my point.
Yeah.
I don't need to lift it out of history,
right,
per se, but to reconcile with what we know.
I mean, I can remember when I was a young Christian, I first read the creationist stuff, and it seemed really exciting because it seemed to be doing the impossible. And it had an explanation for fossils, you know, which is that the flood kind of quickly made them look like fossils. And that seemed very kind of artificial. It was forced. And then some of the more extreme people, some of the more extreme creationists said things like, well, God made fossils to fool us. Some of them said the devil made fossils to fool. I mean, you know, you get into crazy stuff there. I appreciate your point. Anybody else on this? Yeah, one, two, and then we'll go on. Because I got to give you my manifesto. I don't know, because I agree that it's, if you investigate the past, you've got a lot less to go on than if you're observing current data. And yet we do that all the time with history. We put together what we can and we figure out the patterns. And there, you know, I see no reason to dismiss out of court some of the methods of dating that we've used. I mean, they have corroborated some of the more recent history that's, you know, not more than 10,000 years old by other factors. And on one level, you're right. We weren't there. We didn't see it, so we can't observe it, and therefore it's inaccessible. But on another level, we do that all the time with things that aren't immediately present to us. So I think if we go with caution, it's perfectly all right to investigate the past, you know. I mean, there were these fossils, and there were dinosaurs, and there were, creatures that seem to have gone extinct quite a long time ago. I think it's okay to try to work with that. Go ahead. That's a wonderful question. How does a Christian have the proper mistrust of science, but yet the calling to be good in the field? As you suggest, that question, I think, operates across the board. I mean, think of the arts and the media and whatever, you know, you want to be good, but there are dangers there. I think the answer to that, the practical answer, is to go and do it, and to do it well, not to be afraid that it's going to bite you or something, and, you know, get into the labs and go out to the digs and do the experiments. But on a more theoretical level, you're always trying to be bifocal, to use Guinness's terms. You know, there's the creation out there. It's okay to investigate it. You know, Petrarch was right to climb that mountain. But then it's fallen. And so you're going to find not only people and programs that are bent on discarding God in the equation, and their science will be twisted, but it'll be hard to show sometimes. But you'll also find that the evidence itself will be complicated because of the fall. In other words, the fall has intruded right into the object of scientific study somehow. I think you have to go in with your eyes open, knowing that this is God's world. What does Paul say to the Corinthians? This is your world. You'll be judging angels. You know, as it were, go ahead. It's your place. We have a right to it. We have a call to it. But do it with your eyes open, as he says to the Thessalonians. You know, try all things or prove all things. Discard, or keep the good and discard the bad. I see this in the music world where I hang around a lot. You know, there's a lot of bad stuff out there, and it would be easy to just retreat into my own little safe core. The trouble is there isn't any such place. It's another kind of worldliness to retreat. So it's better to just go out there, take some risks, pray a lot, you know, keep yourself spiritually strong, and be very good at what you do. And I would say that in one way, I mean, here because we're talking about apologetics, we've raised these big questions of creation and, evolution and so forth. But most scientists are doing work that is just kind of day to day. I work on a hospital board with a whole bunch of scientists, and many of them who sit with me in this particular committee are oncologists. And they're just trying to cure cancer, just. I mean, they're working on a daily basis. Many of them are Christians or religious people. But they are not asking, they're not tearing their hair out thinking, is this going to disprove God? You know, they're just working hard to be really good at what they do. Now, every now and then there's a border question or liminal question where they say, hey, we can't go there because our patients are at risk, or we can't go there because that particular procedure will never have hopes of duplicating it or whatever. So you get some ethical issues in there. But most scientists are just kind of doing their daily work as people can. That's a good segue into this last thing I wanted to say. I mean, if you want to explore this issue, look at your bibliography. There's lots of stuff coming out on this. We haven't even talked about the whole question of scientific versus divine causality. And that's a huge question to think about. And it would be worth a couple of lectures. How do you measure, you know, so-called natural causes in relationship to God causing things? You know, is it two parallel worlds? The most recent literature suggests an answer called panentheism, which I'm not very comfortable with, but that's where a lot of people are going. This guy Polkinghorne, that was negatively reviewed in the New Republic thing that I read to you last week, he moves in that sort of panentheist, which is to say God is kind of everywhere, doing it in the same way as the secondary causes. There's critical realism, which is saying that there's a reality out there, and then there's our models of it. And we're always trying to get closer, but they'll never quite match. So there's all of this, you know, these are fertile fields for investigation, which I'd encourage you to look into. The place that I wanted to end on this was that Christians, if they are doing science as a call, will probably have a broader reach than many of the narrower polemical issues are suggesting. Christians will be enormously interested in technology. Now, technology is sometimes called the first cousin of science because it's always in tandem with scientific activity. But technology has its own character, its own issues, some of them ethical issues. You know, it's been, you can observe that many of the issues that we have today in science are raised because of what has become possible through technology. And so that's a whole area that we'd want to look at. Medical ethics. Farming, how to feed the world, research ethics, all of these and many more, almost going back to the Royal Academy, are within the scope of what science ought to be thinking about and doing. The relationship of the so-called hard sciences to the soft sciences, or the core sciences to the human sciences. In what sense is sociology a science? In what sense is history a science? So I would make a plea that we go back to that wonderful Kuiperian vision. And he, of course, wasn't as Kuiperian as his own vision suggested, but that's okay. That's why we're here in a new generation doing it. Of having a worldview approach that has something to say and a methodology in each of the fields, and I guess especially since we're just mentioning it here, in science. I'm looking forward at Westminster to the fact that in a couple of years, maybe even shorter than that, we're going to have at least one course on theology and science, and it'll be taught by Vern Poitras, who has degrees in mathematics and theology, you know, because I think it remains a crucial area of discussion. It may not be the one that's the most interesting for you personally, and it may not seem to affect you as an apologist in the direct way that it would others, but it is a crucial issue out there, and there remains lots to say on the presuppositional level. All right, now I'm going to hand out this little thing, and we're going to do some concluding. I'm on my leash here, so help me. I'm going to do some concluding thoughts. Not to pretend that we've covered all the areas we should have with any kind of thoroughness, but I warned you about that at the beginning of the year. The last section of this calls for a look at apologetics and the future. And I jokingly said this is my manifesto. It's kind of a vision, and there's lots of holes in it, lots of things to fill in, lots of amendments to be brought. But these correspond to my personal convictions about where apologetics is now, of course, but more important, where it needs to go in the next few decades, should the Lord tarry. And they're in a kind of priority order, although number 10 is meant to summarize it and bring it together. Number one, and I think this is the particular conviction that is brought to us in the tradition of Westminster, particularly with Cornelius Van Til. I've just sent back a finished manuscript to PNR. They're publishing again Van Til's Christian Apologetics, the book you're reading. You will be the last students to read it in the old edition. The new one will have annotations and introductions and so forth. I was impressed once again at how easily Van Til moves from the domain of theology to the domain of apologetics, while at the same time respecting the sovereignty of the other disciplines. It's an amazing, and maybe this is one of the reasons he was so isolated, because you'll speak to many, many apologists today who really think that philosophy or social analysis or whatever it is the fodder of Christian apologetics, not theology, or not specifically theology. And it's just not true. Apologetics, I agree with John Frame. I don't know if I would put it exactly this way, but I agree with his sentiment. Apologetics is a branch of theology. Because theology is making sense of God's revelation. And so it has to center on God's greatness, on his glory, on his goodness, his love. That's the beginning and the end, the arche. That's what we're defending when we defend the Christian worldview. It's got to center on the dignity of women and men created by God as his image. And even though fallen, that image is there. And there's, as the Sermon on the Mount says, we are of far greater worth than sparrows and flowers and so on. And all that implies. The bifocal vision that we heartily, strongly believe in the creation and its integrity, its original, pristine goodness. But at the same time, we believe it's become twisted, gone wrong, which includes the noetic effect of sin, the effect of sin on the mind, the inability of our mind to reason properly without the corrective force of special revelation. Van Til's image there of, it's a little homey, but it's pretty good, of the guy who's trying to cut his 2x4s, and his son comes into the workshop and changes the setting. You know, when you have there's nothing wrong with the 2x4s or the saw, but the setting is off, and that's the way our mind is with sin. And then finally, all of the questions revolving around what we do with Revelation, the sense of deity leading to the point of contact, what's common grace, how should we think God's thoughts after him, and so forth. So that's theology as apologetics. Secondly, well, one last time, the transcendental approach. A truly transcendental approach seeks to penetrate deep into the fabric and the framework of someone's life and thought in order to uncover what are the preconditions, the setting in the chains in the buzzsaw that that give that position its features. And as you've heard here, this involves a two-step approach, two-phase approach. First, by laying bare the inconsistencies between what is claimed and what is real life. And second, by preaching the gospel, bringing the person to awareness of where home is, coming to himself. That method is amazingly broad and amazingly specific. It's not a 10 steps. It's not a quick kind of classical proof. It's a wisdom approach. Third, there is, I think, very much still a philosophical discipline that needs to be kept in the purview, on the forefront. Particularly since epistemology is one of the major questions facing Christian apologists. How do we know for sure? What's my warrant for belief? Or in Van Til's terms, how can I make predications? How can I give meaning or value to anything? Is critical realism the right biblical approach? Is analogy the right approach, and so forth? This is remains a crucial area. Yet, fourth, apologetics, to have flesh on it and to be conversant with where people are, must be done in a cultural mode, must be aware of social and psychological dimensions to life, cultural apologetics, as some people would call it. And remember, we talked briefly about how this works. We take seriously where people are living and moving and having their being. And it's usually not just in a narrow epistemological area. It's usually in some kind of structure of plausibility, as we said. How does Christianity have an impact on the arts, on the sciences, on family life, on citizenship, on the place where people live? How does it have an impact on their symbol making, on their products? And remember the quip that Marx and Engels succeeded not so much because of the utterly persuasive nature of their very dense philosophical treatises, but because with phrases like opiate of the masses and workers of the world unite, you have nothing to lose but your chains, they communicated in a cultural and psychological way to a generation that felt itself alienated by the bourgeoisie and by the church. A couple of specific issues that I think perhaps have gained particular prominence in recent times, or at least have helped redefine the issues. And we've gone over this ground quite a lot. The move from modernity in its classic form to the more global, urbanized, and dare I say it, postmodern form, if it really is an appropriate diagnosis. In other words, classical modernity being that combination of the Enlightenment mentality and the 19th century social rooting of that mentality, which gave us meta-narratives, faith in reason, trust in progress, democracy, market economy, bureaucratic state, and so on, that's still very much with us. It's very much a filter through which much of the West sees things, and much of the non-West as well. But the move really has been from that to a far broader, more particular emphasis. I was reading a book recently on Christianity and science, which suggested that one of the reasons we're kind of behind in the discussion is because we used to speak of the scandal of particularity that was Christianity. Meaning, in the modern time, because of meta-narratives and a kind of airtight scientific method, we needed to show Christianity was something that was, it was universally true, but only through the scandal of the particular Jesus Christ, the particular revelation of the biblical times. And that was very hard to believe in a modern context. I mean, modernity, by definition, is universal. It claims to be. Deism arose in modernity and so on. But today, a lot more people accept the particular. In fact, the problem for some people is the universal. I mean, we all accept that you've got your way, I've got my way, my convictions, my way of doing things, almost in a fragmented fashion. So we're moving to another kind of modernity, which is more globalized, exchange of goods and ideas and monies and so forth across the cultural barriers, far more urbanized, and which actually makes, ironically, universals much harder to argue for. Six, the problem of evil. Sorry to give you this laundry list here, but it may help to summarize things. No way we can overestimate the centrality, the crucial factor of our confrontation with evil. And we've just finished going over that. I'm not going to go over it again, but you know, you just can't do a luxurious type of apologetics that argues people into the kingdom by a bunch of proofs that is not sensitive to the big question that faces most of us, whether it be injustice in Africa, or it be the Twin Towers, or it be Auschwitz, or it be personal evil, or an enemy we have, or a disease we're riddled with. Enough said. Seventh, pluralism, relativism, diversity. We didn't do much with this in a direct way in the course, possibly for lack of time, but also because it was woven into other things. But how do you differentiate between the social fact of pluralism with its positive side and the wet blanket of relativism and the threat of the negative side of pluralism? How do you navigate those waters as a Christian? As you know, one of the great fears in much of our modern society is to confront a fundamentalist. That term is tossed around a lot. It certainly can mean a Christian fundamentalist, but it now tends to mean Islamic fundamentalism, Hindu fundamentalism. And the fundamentalist is the person who won't play the game and is dangerous because of that. How do you keep your convictions that there is one truth and one way of salvation through Christ, and yet live in a world and argue that you are not celebrating uniformity but diversity? Eighth, we've just done this, but science, technology, the hermeneutics of reality, and biblical hermeneutics in order to figure out how that all meshes together. I think that issue is not going to go away. We're going to be faced pragmatically with it more and more, ethically with it. We're going to be faced with it in terms of our preferred solutions to modern problems, more transportation, better space program, whatever it might be. And as we were suggesting before, the legitimate calling to go and investigate the world as part of who God wants us to be. Now, it's my strong conviction that apologetics needs to live more comfortably in the church. I think we tend to think of apologetics as an academic discipline that's done only in special circles or by specially gifted people. And I think we should have a much broader vision than that. If we go with Van Til's image of the scout going out and exploring things and then coming back and telling the army what to do, at the very least, apologetics should be there in our preaching, because it informs preaching of what the issues are out there that we need to apply the gospel to. I often sit in churches and listen to the sermon with two types of ears. One is to be edified, and try not to be critical. The other is I listen as though I were a non-Christian or one of my relatives who's not a believer. How would this hit them? And often, not always, but often, I find that the language and the applications just have little or nothing to do with their world that they're living in. It could be a beautiful piece of work, a beautiful artwork of a sermon, and with quotes from different sources, and it could be beautifully constructed. But I try to think of a couple of family members who, if they were sitting there, they wouldn't dislike it. It just it wouldn't have any connection whatsoever with their world. And of course, apologetics is this tandem activity with evangelism, and it ought to be a part of theological education. We're trying very much to connect with some of the Christians in New York City, as you probably know, and the most recent round of discussions has resulted in their asking us to provide theological education for them that will produce cultural leadership. And I think that's a wonderful thing. I'm hoping very much that we'll be able to do this, because that's what's needed in many of our urban settings, needed all over. But what is cultural leadership? How are we going to develop models of what that is? We need to work on apologetics for the ordained person, but also for the lay person who is not going to be called to the ministry. Apologetics across the board, but especially in the church. And then finally, going back to the very thing we started with, 1 Peter 3:15, that if we're always going to be ready to give a reason for the hope that we have, an apologia, it requires two conditions to be done in a biblical way. The first is lifting up Christ, worshiping Christ in our hearts. Christ, who died and was raised for our justification, does not go into heaven and let us do apologetics as best we can, but he continues to live in us and to be the object of our worship. And even in the midst of the enterprise or the ministry of apologetics, we ought to be doing that. We ought to be worshiping. I call it a ministry because there is a ministry aspect to apologetics. And behind that, there is an adoration aspect. And finally, humility. None of us has enough of it. The text in 1 Peter calls us to give answers. And obviously, for our hope, we give answers with courage. But also, we give answers with great humility. We didn't invent them. The person asking us is also an image bearer. We dare not use arguments as a clever way to get the better of them. We're like the famous beggars. We happen to have food, and we're leading other beggars to the place of the food. So that's a vision for apologetics, maybe it's a challenge for us, something that can encourage us, but that's what I wanted to leave you with. 2 minutes for questions. Get them back to worldview thinking, get them back to the legitimacy of calling in every field, get them back to the idea that God, although he does ask us to speak of him, and he asks specialists like ministers to speak of him all the time, he doesn't ask most of us to use our jobs as only a support role for opportunities, but to do well, work with our hands, honor him. This may sound funny to say, but evangelism isn't the first goal of the Christian. It is an important goal, but worship, honoring God, is the first goal, and then evangelism has to be done in a biblical way. I think stop me if I've told you this story, but this friend of ours who's a world-class musician, who, he's on the world stage, I won't tell you who it is, and I once asked him how his Christianity affected his musicianship, and he said, well, I try not to give my enemy my strategy. And I sort of said, what? And he said, yeah, I play as well as I can so that people will be attracted to what I'm doing, and then I have a tape in my pocket that I give them of my testimony. And then I go home and I feel my work has been done, you know. And so we discussed this, and I don't think he needs to go there. He doesn't have to give a tape out to feel his work has been done. His work has been done if he played well. And if he happens to get opportunities, well, praise the Lord. But if he doesn't, well, praise the Lord too. So, yeah. I think we better quit.